You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hey there, I'm Steve Chiatakis.
Strong! Do you think they can hear us now?
Oh, we can hear. Tens of thousands of pro-Armenia demonstrators shut down Wilshire Boulevard in Beverly Hills this weekend, calling for an end to violent conflict between Armenia and Azerbaijan. It is a dispute that is decades old, born in the post-Soviet era, over a mountainous region called Artsakh. But it feels close to home for LA's large and well-organized Armenian community. There have been bombings by both sides and casualties estimated in the hundreds.
I'm 19 years old, and all my brothers who are on the front line currently fighting are around my age, 2000, 2001, 2002. And them risking their lives on the front line, this is the least I can do, come out and show my support.
It's Darren Mansourian, who lives in Glendale. He says he lost a friend fighting for the Armenian armed forces. Some civilians have also been killed, others displaced. There have been protests all across Greater LA for weeks now. And KCRW's Benjamin Gottlieb has been covering them. He joins me right now. Hi, Benjamin.
Hello, Steve.
Tell us a little bit more about what the conflict is about in Azerbaijan. This is within the boundaries of Azerbaijan, right?
Yeah, that's right. And just like any conflict or border dispute, it's really easy to be reductive. But here are the cliff notes. Both nations are fighting over a region that's called Nagorno-Karabakh. There was a war there in the early 1990s. This is an area that's entirely inside the borders of Azerbaijan, as you mentioned. So picture West Hollywood surrounded by LA. That's a good way to think about it. Almost all of the people who live there are ethnically Armenian. And those folks have declared their own independent republic that they call Artsakh. Azerbaijan, of course, rejects this. And since the early 90s, this dispute has sort of gone unaddressed.
And of course, here we are. It has blown up. Why is this flared up right now?
Yeah, so there's been a shaky ceasefire that for the most part has held since 1994. There have been some flare-ups, as you say, but nothing like we've seen this year. Both sides blame the other for this current conflict. Now, I should say many international observers say Azerbaijan started the violence, but Azerbaijan says it was the Armenians in Artsakh.
There have been demonstrations for weeks now, Benjamin, and I wonder because the protesters they've marched to the Turkish consulate, they've tried to make their points known. What are they hoping to achieve being so far away?
Well, I should say that some are actually headed to the front lines to actually fight. But here at home, there are two main goals that you can kind of boil this down to. The first is raising money. And to that end, I met Tanya Karamian outside the St. Mary's Armenian Apostolic Church in Glendale late last week. There was a candlelight vigil there that was being held for the victims of the conflict. And Karamian said that she was selling Armenian flags and T-shirts to raise money to send back home.
They're attacking innocent civilians, peaceful civilians. They've been bombing kindergartens and people's houses and schools and churches and causing fires and just havoc all throughout the nation. And so we're just trying to do our best to raise money and get our voices heard, which is why we're here in the streets, closing down freeways, closing streets.
Steve, there's another element here as well, and that's visibility. Demonstrators in the U.S. are hoping for more media coverage about this conflict. And I spoke with Aram Apanian about this. He and his friends have been involved in a few of the events around L.A. in recent weeks, including last week's vigil. And he says he's been glued to the news, watching videos from the BBC.
And I was able to recognize my godfather's wife and her daughter there in the video in a bunker trying to get away from the bombing. And I think that, unfortunately, the majority of the world, they present it in a false, neutral way of showing what's going on. At the end of the day, if we stop the fighting, it'll result in a genocide. If they stop the fighting, it'll result in peace. I think it's a very one-sided story here.
Now, of course, this is the Armenian-American perspective. This is not at all how the Azerbaijani community sees this issue.
All right, well, let's unpack that then, because there's been a lot of activism on the part of Armenia and by Armenian Americans. We've seen donation campaigns, large-scale demonstrations, as witnessed over the weekend and in recent weeks, social media posts. What about on the part of the Azerbaijani community? I'm sure it's a much smaller community here in L.A., right?
Yeah, it is. And there's a couple reasons why you haven't heard so much from the Azerbaijani community. For one, even though there are a large number of Azerbaijanis that live in California, I wouldn't be out of line to say they're not as organized as the Armenian community. Now, I did catch up with Nasimi Agayev to talk more about the Azerbaijani perspective. He is the nation's consul general based here in Los Angeles. Agayev is very critical of many elected officials in Los Angeles, including Burbank Congressman Adam Schiff, LA Mayor Eric Garcetti. Both of those folks have made public statements in support of Armenia and the Republic of Artsakh.
They parrot word by word the Armenian official propaganda, again, black and white. Armenians are angels, Azerbaijanis are demons. This kind of narrative, which is absolutely disgusting.
He also feels news organizations in the U.S. take the Armenian side all the time. At demonstrations, you hear Armenian Americans as well who are very upset with Azerbaijan. But there's also another element, Steve. They're very upset with Turkey.
All right, Turkey. Is Turkey involved in this as well, Benjamin?
They are. Turkey is supporting Azerbaijan in this fight. And some Armenians see this conflict as Turkish aggression. One of those folks is Levon Abrahamian. I met him yesterday on the streets. He was there with several helium tanks blowing up red balloons and handing them out to protesters. The balloons, he says, represent the Turkish flag and the blood that's on the hands of Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. He explains his activism to me in this way.
So a group of us got together and decided that let's analyze what's happening. You know, what is Turkey doing? What is Erdogan doing? Right now, he's full of hot air. He's just like these balloons, and the international community needs to come together and pop this balloon. This is a continuation of the Armenian genocide. They are trying to ethnically cleanse us, but Turkey's trying to be sneaky about it and use a puppet regime from Azerbaijan to do it.
And Steve, this is not a fringe perspective. Many Armenians I spoke to see this conflict in this way. They see it as an extension of Turkish aggression and the Armenian genocide. Now, as for the Azerbaijanis, they see this conflict as one between neighbors and not influenced by other nations. In their mind, Nagorno-Karabakh is theirs.
If we start revisiting all these historic issues, we will go nowhere. What matters today is that Azerbaijan has this international recognized borders. Azerbaijan is not fighting or doing anything within the Republic of Armenia. Azerbaijan is defending its own territory, own land, own people, on its own soil.
Now, there have been reports, Steve, of some shelling inside of Armenia proper, so there's some dispute as to whether or not that's accurate, which you just heard. But again, for Armenians, there's an alarming number of parallels to the Armenian genocide here.
I mean, right. During the First World War, an estimated 1.5 million Armenians were systematically killed by the Ottoman Empire, which is modern day Turkey. And Turkey to this day has not even acknowledged it. Right. They said this was just, you know, the conflict that was going on at the moment.
You're right. And the U.S. federal government also has not officially recognized this as well. So echoes of that painful history, they're all over this current conflict and these demonstrations as well. Speaking of demonstrations, I met Jasmine Tatoyan at the Wilshire Boulevard protest. She was there with her sister, her two nieces, and her daughter, Noram, who she says she often takes to these types of events.
Well, we all actually gathered here for the fight of our culture, and it's very, very strong culture for us, and we're all ready to fight for our country. Yeah.
What sort of feelings does that evoke for you?
Well, I think at a young age, they need to know what they stand for, and us Armenians, always, no matter what, we all come together. And they need to know that at this age, that even though we live here in the U.S., that our motherland, our homeland, is in Armenia.
Speaking of Armenia, Steve, the violence appears to be continuing despite the announcement of a ceasefire over the weekend. It does not look like it's holding completely, so still a very volatile situation in the Caucasus region there.
And a situation that we're going to keep an eye on, of course. KCRW's Benjamin Gottlieb covering the story for us. Benjamin, as always, thanks.
You're welcome, Steve.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Moving on now with KCRW's Greater LA, and adding to the long list of things affected by the pandemic, counting people in the United States. Census officials this year said they couldn't do an accurate count by their usual August deadline, and they extended it to the end of October. But then the Trump administration turned around and ordered the counting to stop at the end of September. A federal judge here in California blocked that decision, and the Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals agreed. Well, now the case sits before the U.S. Supreme Court. A lot is at stake, of course. Paul Ong is research professor at the Luskin School of Public Affairs and director of the UCLA Center for Neighborhood Knowledge. Professor, welcome.
Thank you.
Why is it so important to get the count right?
It's important for political and economic reasons. Politically, it's because that's how we allocate congressional seats. That's how we draw boundaries for electoral districts. Economically, because we use the data to allocate resources and services, both in the private sector and the public sector.
How does it usually work in a typical census year? What are the deadlines in a census year?
The census officially starts April 1st, but we actually send out postcards to have people fill out the questionnaire earlier. And that's stage one. And we hope to get a large number of households responding that way. For the households that don't respond, we go into the second major stage. That's when we send census takers out and knock on doors to get you to fill out the questionnaire. So those are the two major census. With the pandemic, it disrupted both stage one and stage two of that effort.
But usually the deadline to get all of the responses in is when? It's usually in August, right?
It is towards the end of the summer. It could vary a little bit, certainly, you know, under today's circumstances, it needs to be varied. And so we know by tracking the self-response rate that we were a month or 2 months behind, and we continue to fall behind. So by the end of the summer, we knew that we were in trouble in terms of people responding initially. And the other challenge is the follow-up with the pandemic. It's very difficult to get census people out there knocking on doors. And also it's very difficult for people to be responsive. So you have the pandemic, but you also have the fear because the politicalization of the whole process. The White House certainly has not made it easy for a number of people, including immigrants, to participate.
Well, we know there was the administration plan to put a citizenship question on the census form. The Supreme Court intervened in that. There were obviously lawsuits, and the Supreme Court said, no, you can't do that. What about the response rate in L.A.? What are we seeing as far as numbers go compared to, say, 10 years ago?
I think in the earliest stages, like I said, we were several months behind. And much of that is concentrated in communities of color, low-income communities, immigrant communities. So we already start seeing at the very beginning, a month or two into the census, that these neighborhoods were being adversely impacted. And then also, if you look at the follow-up, we also see problems, particularly in these types of neighborhoods and these particular types of areas. So that's a problem that we know we've been monitoring. But even if they're able to get to every household, there's a big question about how accurate the counts will be. In 2010, about 5% of the household, we did not get correct information. And my fear is that it's going to be much worse this time around.
At this point, Professor, with the deadline in limbo, we don't know when the counting is going to stop, you know, whatever the Supreme Court does. What do you think needs to be done or can be done to get a more accurate count? Is that even possible at this point?
I think what's possible after the census, after enumeration, is that we need to do serious analysis and serious research to understand the patterns of the undercount, the patterns of the differential undercount. That means doing the type of research, follow-up research, that essentially identifies the neighborhoods and populations that have been left out. Now, clearly the Census Bureau should be doing that, but I don't think it may do an accurate and adequate job. So I think in many ways we need to mobilize essentially third parties, people who do not have a political vested interest in either promoting the undercount or somehow rigging the census in a political fashion. So I think there's a need for independent research that essentially allows us to understand the patterns of the differential undercount and make adjustments for it.
I have to ask, I mean, obviously there's politics involved in this, and there has been politics right. involved in the census count. And I wonder, you know, and I don't want to just blatantly say how much of this is politics, how much of this is, you know, this Republican administration knows that the people who are not being counted are typically the people who would vote for Democrats. And they right. know that the fewer people... Go ahead.
Right. You're absolutely right. It's sort of like playing a competitive game, basketball, football, and your team's ahead, right? So rather than waiting for the end of the game, you want to cut off the game, you know, when you're ahead. So essentially, I think that's my personal interpretation of what's going on. Now, whether there's evidence of that, who knows? I think we will eventually find out, because eventually people provide additional information about how this was implemented, how this was stymied. So I don't usually try to take too strong of a political stance, but my personal opinion is that this is like lots of other things in terms of what's been happening out of the White House, which is essentially trying to rig the game. The same way we see in terms of the mail-in ballots, to set the rules in such a fashion that really tips the power towards the current incumbent.
Paul Ong is research professor at the Luskin School of Public Affairs and directs the UCLA Center for Neighborhood Knowledge. Professor, thanks for being with us.
I appreciate you guys doing this. I appreciate you guys
covering
this story. Thank you,
Professor.
Thank you.
And by the way, if you haven't completed your census form yet, get it done. Go to 2020census.gov. That's 2020census.gov. Thanks for being with us for Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Voting is happening all across California with tens of thousands of ballots already returned by mail or drop box all up and down the state. And we're watching a couple of close races in the county of Orange. A couple of years ago, the county's entire congressional delegation turned blue when Democrats ran the table in 2018. But can that blue momentum continue in 2020? Incumbent Harley Ruta is running for a second term representing the coast from Steel Beach to Aliso Viejo. But County Supervisor Michelle Steele has other plans. And Congressman Gil Cisneros has a rematch against former State Assemblywoman Young Kim to represent Yorba Linda to Fullerton to Hacienda Heights. Gustavo Arellano writes for the LA Times. He's a regular contributor here at KCRW's Greater LA. Hey, Gustavo.
Hola, Steve.
So let's start with Cisneros and Kim. This is the 39th congressional district. They have faced off before. Last time during that blue wave, it was incredibly close. What's it looking like this time?
Same as it ever was. Incredibly close. Young Kim is a really interesting candidate. She's like the Atlanta Braves of the 1990s, but in Orange County politics. So she first ran against Sharon Quirk Silva, lost, then beat her. Then lost, in 2018, lost to Gil Cisneros. So now she's trying. Maybe finally she'll be able to win. But she's going up against a guy who is not exactly the most liberal member of Congress or even the Orange County delegation, but it serves him right for a district that's probably the most diverse one in Orange County, where literally the voters break down roughly a third white, a third Asian, and a third Latino.
Yeah, this is a district that also extends into part of L.A. County as well, right?
And San Bernardino County, little slivers of it. So, but it's mostly in northern Orange County, so we're talking Fullerton, Brea, Yorba Linda, a little bit wealthier, but also, again, a district that, like the rest of Orange County, has been changing over the past 15 to 20 years. So, it'll be interesting. If young Kim wins, she would be the first ever Korean-American elected into Congress. So there's a lot of attention being put on this race, but Gil hasn't angered people enough to reject him.
All right, let's move on now to Ruta and Steele. Ruta flipped the 48th district a couple of years ago when he beat longtime Congressman Dana Rohrabacher. That was a big surprise. Steele has said it's going to be hard work to win this, but points to her proven track record on the Board of Supervisors. This is coastal Orange County, right? This is the different part of Orange County that you always talk about, right?
The different, to put it lightly. No, this is a Rock Rib Republican Central traditionally. Of course, this was the district occupied for over 20 years by the infamous Dana Rohrabacher, and Harley Ruta is even more conservative than Gil. He's going on in commercials saying, look, I voted against my party. I've try to do bipartisanship with my fellow Republicans out in Congress, but that's not enough for someone like Michelle Steele, who she would also be a first Korean American ever elected to Congress. But she is very much of the Trump supporting, against gay marriage, against abortion type of Republican. And of course, in Orange County, though, if people know her at all besides being a Board of Supervisors, it's been for her track record on coronavirus. As I've said now on Greater LA, geez, this will probably be the sixth or seventh time, but let's not forget that right before Memorial Day, Michelle Steele put out a press release saying that hospitalization rates were going down in regards to COVID-19 in Orange County, and the curve has been flattened. Famous last words, we'll see.
Before we let you go, Gustavo, I want to talk about these unofficial drop boxes that have been popping up across the state. In the Central Valley and Fresno, we've seen them pop up in parts of LA County and also in Orange County as well, often at local GOP candidate headquarters, churches, gun shops, things like that. Who's behind it? And is this what's called ballot harvesting? What's going on here?
So it seems the California Republican Party, so the entire state apparatus, is behind this. People are trying to make it out to be like this insidious effort by the GOP, just like they have in the past, to suppress voters. But no, this is a ham-fisted attempt by the Republican Party to tell its voters, hey, you don't trust a registrar of voters or the post office to put in your mail-in ballot? Well, we'll collect it for you. So under state law in California, third parties can collect voter ballots from other people. They're going to be mail-in as long as people sign off on it and saying, yeah, we're giving it to someone else. And that's what the Republican Party is saying this is trying to be about. But, just on Sunday, Secretary of State Alex Padilla said, like, yeah, you can't put out boxes anywhere and say, call it official. Even though if you see the official, they all look the same and it all looks like it came off of a Microsoft PowerPoint presentation.
But is there any kind of, malfeasance going on here with these unofficial boxes?
No, I more than anyone is very hard on the Republican Party, not just statewide, but especially in Orange County. This is just a ham-fisted attempt at what the Republicans were accusing the Democrats of doing in 2018, what they called ballot harvesting then, even though ballot harvesting is a very specific legal term that you can't use. They're just trying to get their own voters to vote, and they're trying to make into like this, oh, look, let's all go against the Dems and the, evil taxifornia. But it's not. It's not insidious. It's just ham-fisted, weak salsa politicking by the Republican Party, which really shows how desperate they are to try to make any gains in California.
And by the way, the Orange County District Attorney, Todd Spitzer, his office now says they are investigating these vote collection boxes, these unofficial ones, these counterfeit ones that are placed throughout the county. So this story obviously is not going away anytime soon. Gustavo Arellano with today's KCRW Orange County Line. Gustavo, thanks.
Gracias.
And again, the Secretary of State's office is now demanding those private ballot collection containers be gotten rid of, that they are illegal under state law. So we will keep monitoring that story as we go forward. Of course, other stories as well, with our Power in Numbers fundraiser in full force. It has all the qualities of an UNDRIVE in that we're not interrupting the program, outside of a few mentions throughout the day and the importance of a campaign to protect and strengthen public radio. If this kind of thoughtful stuff is important to you, the news and the culture and the shows, the music, the identity, the connection, then It would be a great time to have you help support it, too. Mornings with Terry Glazer providing you the news. Ann Litt, Morning Becomes Eclectic, giving you handpicked and taste-making music. Madeline Brand, Press Play each and every day, covering all the topics that you care about. How much do those things mean to you? How much is KCRW a part of your life? Is it worth, say, how much you pay for a cup of coffee every morning? Or worth how much you pay for a nice big carry-out dinner once or twice a month? Add your name, or increase your number, perhaps, to help keep the radio station strong and healthy. It's been a tough time for a lot of people, us too. Whatever you can do helps. If you can't, no worries. If you can, think about giving for others to the station that is LA. KCRW.com/give. Monthly giving amazing. $20, $32, $100 a month goes so far. Thank you for your support of KCRW. KCRW.com/give. Jenna Cagle, Catherine Barnes, Sonia Geis, Desmond Taylor, Ray Guarna, Phil Richards, Mario Saavedra, Amy Taub, Mike Stark, and Christian Bordahl all made this show happen. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Thanks for your ears and time. Have a great night.